And good morning.
Good morning.
Such a nice day. And it's nice to see old friends here. So I'm going to talk a little bit this morning about Dogen, but not something we usually think of when we think of Dogen, because I'm going to talk about his poetry. He's very well known for writing, you know, difficult, dense essays on the nature of being, but he also was a poet. And there's one poem in here which I won't read to you, but it's quite touching. He loved words, but as a good Zen teacher, he sat shikantaza, he sat just sitting. And of course, the idea is you let go of your thoughts and of your words. In one of his poems, he sort of confesses that he can't resist writing poetry. He feels just an easy bit guilty, but he's got to do it. So there's some quite wonderful thing. This particular volume is called The Zen Poetry of Dogen, translated by Stephen Heine. And there's a particular poem in it that has become enormously famous. If any of you saw that movie called Zen, which was a sort of semi-fictionalized account of Dogen's life, it turns up there. You hear it there. Emperor, actually, the young emperor, repeats it to him. And in 1968, Yasunari Kawabata, the first Japanese author to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature, opened his acceptance speech in Stockholm with a surprising reference to a poem by Dogen. Nobody expected him to do that. He was a great novelist in his own right. Dogen's poetry had been sort of overshadowed by his philosophical writings. And this was a particularly simple poem that nevertheless Kawabata insisted transmitted the very essence of Japan. There was a lot of discussion after that about why did he use that, etc., etc. Here's the poem. I'm going to read it first in Japanese so you'll see how short and simple it is, and then give you the translation. Haru wa hana, natsu hotodogisu, aki wa tsuki, fuyu yuki kie de suzushi karikeri. Short, simple. And Edward Seidensticker's translation is, in the spring, cherry blossoms. In the summer, the cuckoo. In autumn, the moon. And in winter, the snow, clear, cold. In the spring, cherry blossoms. In the summer, the cuckoo. In autumn, the moon. And in winter, the snow, clear, cold. That's it. And I at least readily think of it as Japanese because of the cherry blossoms and the cuckoo, the hototogisu, which you hear a lot. But then I think we have to say, well, what does this poem say to us? Is it so specifically Japanese that it isn't going to mean very much to us? So I thought it might be helpful to create a new Milwaukee version. In spring, the daffodils. Summer, white sails on the lake. In autumn, geese cross the moon. Winter, down coats, bitter cold. So you can see it is about the rolling of the seasons, that cycle of life that is applicable to everyone. And, you know, in each poem, the seasons progress. They unfold our lives, whether we're in Japan or Wisconsin or Siberia or France. It doesn't really matter. The seasons come. Even in the very tropical countries, there are differences. We understand that plants and the temperature and the rain and the sun all respond to this turning of the earth on its axis. You know, there's a slight difference in the two poems, however, because I included in my little version human activities as seasonal markers. So the poem is a little bit less impersonal than Dogen's. You know, so he's using just natural things, cherry blossoms, the cuckoo, moon, snow. But I think each poem speaks of the way in which we experience the cycles of life. both universally abstract and at the same time intensely personal. You know, all of us feel the sunshine today, the first we've had in a long time. And it says to us, well, it's spring at last. But I think each one of us has a slightly personal response to that sunshine and what spring means to us. So it's as though our life, which is revolving, is enfolded inside the big cycle of the earth as the seasons come and go. And if we merely observe them, you know how nice it is out today, I think we miss their deep connection to our lives. And this is why Dogen, I think, I'm guessing here, I'm interpreting, Dogen chose such vivid, singular images so that we cannot help but respond. You know, if we say moon, each one of us has a kind of instinctive personal reaction to that word. And part of this, I believe, is because our lives move through inexorable cycles too. Childhood, adolescence, maturity, old age. And yet somehow these sort of stream by without our notice. Yet I think our lives could be much richer if we open our eyes to see the geese flying south. Even as our mature years show richness of experience combined with the first signs of physical decline. We tend to think of impermanence, meaning things are going. We forget that things are coming. And along with the, you know, vivid strength and action of youth comes all the uncertainties of being very young and a different take on life. Along with the physical decline of growing older comes sometimes a rich experience because we've had memories that have built up and they enrich what's happening for us. Ways that you don't have when you have the benefit of terrific physical activity. I went to one of the Amazing Faiths dinner that the Interfaith Conference is sponsoring a week or so ago. And in this case, the topic that we were to think about was food and eating. So one of the questions was, think about something that happened in your life, you know, about food and how you responded to it. And all of a sudden, I remembered two things which have made me view things in themselves very differently than if I hadn't had those experiences. One is elderberry pie. As a kid, I picked elderberries along the rural roads where I lived, and my mother made fabulous elderberry pie. But when I was in England in 1953 with my college roommate, we went to visit a young woman that I had corresponded with as a pen pal. You know, now it's all email, but then it was pen pals during World War II. So at last we were going to meet Peggy and her family. And again, Peggy's mother said, what's one of your favorite foods? And I said, oh, my mother made wonderful, wonderful elderberry pie. And there was a long pause. And Mrs. Reed said, but that's poison. And we had a long discussion. And we were describing the berries. She was insistent. When I got home from this trip, I went to, you know, a grocery store and I got a commercially bottled, you know, jar of elderberry jam. And I mailed it to England along with, it was still an era when we sent kind of a care package, you know, to them. I never heard whether they ate it or not. But every time, if I see on a menu elderberry pie, you know, this whole thing comes up. So for me, elderberry pie has a different meaning than for somebody else. And then the other thing has to do with situations. And that was that when I was at Shogoji Monastery, you want to get a stool, that's okay.
No, this is fine.
Oh, okay, all right. Whatever, you know, make yourself comfortable. when I was at Shogoji Monastery, we didn't get very much sleep, and we got up about 3:30 in the morning, and it was cold, and it was dark, and we sat two, you know, full periods of zazen, and then came breakfast. And breakfast in a Japanese monastery is very, very simple. You have brown rice gruel, brown rice soup, basically. You have hot brown rice, a few vegetables, and then maybe you get an umeboshi, a pickled plum. The idea being, they really believe that if you put that pickled plum in your rice gruel, you'd live forever. Umeboshi are good for everything, sort of. Well, of course, it was very simple. And you had a little gomasho, the sesame salt to put on your rice. But it was cold, it was early, I was tired. I used to wait for that okayu, as it was called, as though it were caviar. It was the best meal I've ever eaten, I think. It was hot, and it was good. And so to this day, I look at brown rice okayu differently than if somebody just plunked it in front of me and you say, well, it's boiled rice and a lot of water. It doesn't have the same impact. But I think what I'm trying to get after is that if we can appreciate, and I don't really mean appreciate in the sense of like, I appreciate it because I like it, but in the sense of recognizing the full worth of something. I appreciated this experience. I know that Tozen Akiyama, my teacher, used to use the word appreciate a lot. Say, we must appreciate our lives. So did Mayazumi Roshi. And people say, well, now wait a minute. I have sciatica, or I'm pregnant, all these things that we don't particularly love. And they would then explain, experience it fully. Dogen talks about the wholehearted way. So I think if we appreciate the full worth of each day, each moment of each day, then it's a strange thing, because as you go deeper into this day, at the same time your horizons open up. It's quite wonderful. It's quite wonderful. So we can cherish our memories of childhood, adolescence. These are the moments that make us unique human beings, because we each have a private history. It might have been happy, it might have been very unhappy, but it's, for each one of us, it's our private history. No one else shares that, and it makes each one of us quite wonderful and quite unique. But we can, at that point, we can also begin to understand that of necessity, the cherry blossoms are followed by the cuckoo, by the moon, by the clear cold of snow. The seasons of necessity follow one another. And interestingly, the cold snow tells us that the cherry blossoms are coming. It's a circle. It's a beautiful, beautiful circle that happens. The daffodils promise the white sails. The white sails promise the geese overhead. That they themselves promise the snows of winter. So this is how it is. It goes in cycles, with nothing to be rejected. Even if we try to reject it, we resist change. As one thing flows into another, we're not going to make it. Things will change in any case. So I think, we sit in zazen, and our practice is letting go of the stuff in our head as much as we're able to. And at that point, we relinquish our desires to be in some other season. Not just because we can't be, really we can't, but because the desire is gone. The moment that we are right here and now is the only moment we ever have. And it's followed by other moments here and now. But what we have in direct experience is this very moment. And that alters a lot of things, because in this very moment, I can appreciate what's happening, I can experience what's happening, I can deal with what's happening, because it's finite. It's just this moment. Now, because of cycles, it's going to be followed by other moments, of course. But I really feel that what our practice does for us is gives us a few of those moments. We do it deliberately. We come in here where there's really nothing to distract us, nothing happening. And then we have all our mind to distract us. But we practice letting it go, to realize that we are settled right here. And once that happens, the poem begins, for me anyway, begins to make sense. Because it says, Haru Wahana, in the spring, cherry blossoms. Not red leaves, the thing that belongs with spring. Natsu hotokisu, in the summer, the cuckoo. Fuyu yukikie de, in autumn, the moon. And in winter, suzushi karikeri, the snow, clear and cold. It's interesting that in the film, Dogen encounters, we know historically he did encounter the young shogun, actually, not an emperor, shogun, who had just completed an enormous civil war. Thousands were killed. We don't actually historically know what happened when Dogen went to Kamakura, and there was this kind of blank period. The idea was he was to go to be an advisor to the shogun. He came back to Eihachi. We don't know. There are a couple of legends about what happened, but he didn't want to take what was offered to him. But in the film, there's a very interesting, even though it's fictional, kind of exchange. The young shogun is half mad with sort of terrible panic attacks that have to do with his anxiety over all the men that have been killed in this war that he led. He actually envisions them coming after him, flying heads, which is a very Japanese thing, but screaming around him. And Dogen has an exchange with him in which they challenge each other, basically. And the shogun does something interesting symbolically. Dogen shows him the moon in the water, because he's about to slice Dogen in half, and says, can you take care of that? Well, of course he can. Just one, whap, and it splinters. Dogen says, wait. Wait, and of course, it comes together again. So they begin to, he does become kind of an advisor in the film. And what is interesting is this particular poem becomes enormously meaningful to the shogun, because he's taught, as quite a young man, that the seasons, one comes after the other, things are in their place, it will happen. And so he quotes this poem to Dogen. First quotes it to him, and then he quotes it to Dogen is leaving in the film. So that the poem speaks of impermanence, and yet, what's the word I want? Impermanence we can trust, cycles of impermanence we can trust. So there are really two kinds of impermanence. One is the inevitable change that is built into life itself. And the other, of course, is the absolutely unpredictable changes that do occur in the middle of all that. But they're not the same. The ones that we know about are comforting in a way. You know, one of the complaints about this spring has been interesting. People say, you know, it's so cold, it's so late, it's so cold, it rains. But I actually saw in the paper that the month of April and now some of May is just a degree or two above normal. Why do we think it's so awful? Because the winter was so long that our desire to have, you know, instant spring, every daffodil up at a temperature of 68, is so big that we're complaining about what is a very average spring. So that these cycles are very natural, and yet we distort out of our reactions to them. So I think in Zazen, we accept how it is, just how it is right now. Nothing cherished, nothing rejected. And in that moment, there's a kind of wonderful freedom, because we're not at the mercy of our likes and dislikes. It's just what it is. Now, yesterday we went outside, and today we will again, to, you know, clear out old things, prepare garden beds to plant new things, and we're now participating in the natural cycle, something I like very, very much. So that's really all I have to say this morning, not very much. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Any comments? Stuff?
I like in the poem that I think it's important that he doesn't say the beautiful cherry blossoms,
yes,
or the terrible cold.
Yes, very important. So he does not afflict them with his responses to them. Which is why sometimes in visual art, or even in music, but certainly in visual art, you'll find an artist painting something and people go, yuck, that's ugly. No, it's not. It's right there. The colors are terrific. You know, the shape is wonderful. But it's an object that they have some kind of revulsion for. And it's a very clear picture then of how we create things differently. Given what we're taught, what we acquire, and actually visual artists, particularly when the swath of modern-ish art called the Impressionist art, and then Cubism, really affected how we see things, actually see them, because they, you know, they looked at them in a slightly different way, saw something different, showed it to us, and now we can see that. And it's why often artists are choosing things that we say, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that. And they say, no, no, look. Look at it. Look at what's happening. Don't say the beautiful cherry blossoms. You know, he's just pointing out these are things that happen. And actually, the Hototo Gisu is delightful unless it's right outside your window and won't shut up, as I've experienced, you know. So... Yes.
Did he say, did the author say, what about that poem was so essentially Japanese?
I don't think he really did, and they struggled with it then. You know, he started his speech, and unfortunately, we may have it here. It's in a thing called Japan. Oh dear, myself and the beautiful. It's the Nobel Prize speech, and I used to have a copy of it. I could not find it. I found this poem, and I remembered the talk. I don't think he really explains. He just says, you know, I'm the first Japanese to receive this prize, and I wanted to share something with you, you know, quintessentially Japanese. And I think what happened, and my memory's a little dim, but there was a foreword to the copy of it that I have. I think some Japanese intellectuals thought it was just too darned simple.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're much more complicated than that. What is this stuff about? Again, see, not the beautiful, lovely, elegant cherry blossoms of Japan. Mm-hmm. He just said cherry blossoms. That's my memory of it. That they expected something. Kawabata's own novels, the only one that I think I read, is called The Snow Country. It's quite beautiful. They're lovely novels. And I think they wanted something more lyrical, something more, you know, and he had chosen, and again, he had not chosen, first place, he'd chosen a philosopher's poetry, and he had not chosen any of their collections of rather famous poets. You know, it was kind of running against the stream. If he had chosen, say, Basho, somebody like that, you know, or Ryokan even, But all of a sudden, he plunks this thing down and says, this is Japan. Now, it is a very clear picture of the seasons in Japan. And then you can, you know, you can mentally go from there into what that might mean concerning life in Japan. Because, again, you say cherry blossoms, and I hadn't, in all the years I've been going, you know, back and forth to Japan, it was fairly recently that I happened to hit it at cherry blossom season. Well, you know, we have the beautiful cherry blossoms in Washington, D.C. that actually the Japanese, you know, gave to us. And we have, of course, flowering trees here. I was unprepared for the fact that in every pot, every plot of earth, every park, every forest, every roadway, every backyard were cherry blossoms. I mean, they were everywhere. And then if you go to a park, they're in such masses that it's almost, you know, hard to imagine. So when, you know, you say cherry blossoms, you say, well, that's nice. We have lots of apple blossoms and plum blossoms. But when I suddenly saw, like, the whole country had just lit up. And, of course, they don't last very long. Which is another thing about the whole Japanese psyche, their own very powerful sense of the evanescence and the impermanence of things. It's why you get so many poems about cherry blossoms falling and so on, because it's a short season. But I remember I was just stunned, because I'd never seen the fact that they were everywhere. You couldn't avoid cherry blossoms for, you know, 3 or 4 days only when they're like that. And it also speaks of the Japanese appreciation of it. At that time, I happened to be at one point in Tokyo, and I went to Ueno Park, which is this enormous park quite near the place I was staying. And they have, you know, long walkways with these cherry blossoms. Well, everybody's out. They got the blankets out. They have the radios out. They've got the sake out, the food. Everybody's partying for that brief, you know, period. In fact, the crowds are so huge that I guess you have to stake it out 2 or 3 days in advance to get a place to put your blanket down. And it's one enormous party of a kind of joyousness that says, you know, we better do it now because they're not going to be here pretty soon. It's not what you think of as delicate, you know, 18th century Japan. It's loud and raucous, I mean, but it's wonderful.
There's not a program, it's just everybody comes.
Yeah. You know, and stakes out a little spot. And so, I mean, there are all sorts of different things playing on radios and kids running around. And there may be at some point somewhere in the park on a, you know, on some platform, some kind of program. But it's mostly people just out there picnicking and having a wild time, drinking far too much often. But it's a kind of wonderful, spontaneous explosion, you know, that didn't take organizing. They've always done it. So you read about viewing the cherry blossoms. I remember being in Kyoto in November, I guess, and they have what they call a philosopher's walk there, which is it's a long, narrow walkway, and there are trees on either side. And so we're strolling down philosopher's walk, and the friend says, oh, but you know, in the spring, they were all cherry trees. You know, it does no good to walk down here now when they're all bare. It was kind of like... So he did choose, and the cuckoo, the particular song of the Hototogisu, is, you don't hear it much of anywhere else, you know, it's very, very, so he chose things. The moon is revered in all things Japanese, and of course that has huge significance within Buddhism as a symbol of enlightenment. And the snows are much prized, they're very beautiful. So it makes sense as a poem, but I think people were just annoyed that, you know, this great intellectual who had written these wonderful novels is now going to choose not a famous poet, and no poet that anyone would automatically connect with Japan. So there was a little fuss at the time, but it makes, you know, tremendous sense, and it is one little thing that an awful lot of people in Japan will know is this short little poem. Yes, Marshall.
About 4 o'clock this morning, I was driving home kind of late, early in the morning, I should say. Mm-hmm. But I noticed when it was dark outside, the moon, I could see the the terminator, you know, between the where the light, the daylight is and the night, right on the edge.
Whoa.
But by the time I got over to the driveway and opened that, I took out my camera with a long lens and snapped the picture, but by that time I couldn't see the dark part.
Yeah, the light had overcome it. Yeah,
three or four photographs of the moon. I wish I had them here.
Yeah, to show it. Yeah,
my car.
Oh dear. Well, it's
another thing I recall is Japanese paintings with the calligraphy. They're often very simple, and they make a simple, stark statement, like you said about the cherry blossom. Mm-hmm. And they wait for the, or, you know, the individuals to react to whatever is on there.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. It's also this is going to seem a little silly, but it has to do with what things bring up cultural responses and what things maybe you don't even really know what it might mean. A number of years ago, when Yoy-Hung was the abbess at Phu Khao Vietnamese temple, she invited me to come down and speak to her folks. And they still have a fairly large children's program. There are lots and lots of Vietnamese families that belong.